Canto, and I think maybe today we'll just start right off. In the fifth canto, really the basic thing that's going on is the description of Swayambhuva Manu and Sarupa, and they have sons and daughters. The two sons, Janapada, is one, and the other one is Priyaratha. We hear all about Janapada's descendants, Dhruva, so there's a big long pause, the whole story about Dhruva Maharaj, and so on. Then we go to the other one, Priyaratha, and he was how he was persuaded to become a manager. And so, in the course of telling about Priyaratha, let me just go to, how do I turn this on over here?
Blank.
How do I do this?
There you go.
See, I have made a shadow file of which is the Planetary and Cosmology Project, so I can annotate it just to deal with. You can take photos, you can just make many. Shadow files and different things. This is mine, because in this one I've got, you go to tools and bookmarks, I've got bookmarks here. So here's what happens, we go to the description of Jambudvipa. This is where this really starts up. So here we have text one. Uktastvaya, you see right here, I got a little pop-up note. Shukadeva has already described how Maharaj Priyaratha created the islands of Brahmandala. Because he says, Uktastava, you have already told how this has happened, right? You see, you've already done this. You have already informed me that the radius of Bhumandala extends. So where did he say this? How far the radius of Bhumandala went? As far as the sun spreads its light and heat, and as far as the moon and stars can be seen. By the way, there's a little annotation of my own read here from a purport by Vishwanath Chakravarti, I think, who explains that as far as the Loka mountains. You remember, I'm assuming everybody has a sort of vague knowledge of what, but after you have the ring islands and the oceans doubling in size, and you have this on the Sultra mountain around which the sun goes around, and then, after that last freshwater ocean, you have Kanchanabhumi, the golden land, where you drop something on there, it disappears in the glare, you can't see anything, so nobody lives there. And then there's called the Loka Mountains. And that blocks, the Loka Mountains go all the way up through the Loka. Huh? Yes, yeah, Dhruva Loka to the heavenly planet. So it's, in other words, these mountains are just very, very high. It's a ring of mountains. Basically, if you think of Bhumandala as a lotus, these are the petals that go all the way up, because it encloses this whole area. So the sunlight doesn't go past these Loka Loka mountains, which are extremely high. Beyond that's called Aloka Varsha, where nobody lives. And then there's a bit of a gap, and then there's the shells of the universe. This is what happens. So you've talked about the radius of Bhumandala as far as the sun spreads its light and heat, as far as the moon and the stars can be seen. So now you're reading this. Now, where did he say that, right? Oh, by the way, here's another. Let's see what I put here. I am this word. Oh, extent. When he said radius, I wanted to see what the Sanskrit was. So you got this little pop-up feature. You can put your notes in there. This M.W. Mona Williams Dictionary, the Sanskrit Dictionary, which is conveniently in a machine-readable form now. So that's the word here. That's radius. Right now. Okay. So where did he say this? It was in the first chapter of the fifth canto. So let's go back and look. Because actually it turns out there's some information way back there. So here at text 35.130, we start out. Now this stuff has been added because, I see, the way the word divisions are here are wrong. And so they're corrected. I have a, oh, and this part also. Here's an extra sentence. Some manuscripts, I have Dvijamani as Sanskrit. That's why I know all this stuff. That's why I seem so smart and well-informed, because this particular sentence that I've added here in brackets, it's in some manuscripts of the Bhagavatam. And it is accounted for by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati in his word-for-word in Bengali translation. So I've just put it in. And this just corrects the way the
what does it mean?
Yeah. Okay, here it was down here. It's down here. So here's this thing. While so excellently ruling the universe, King Priyavrata once became dissatisfied with the circumambulation of the most powerful sun god, encircling Sumeru Hill on his chariot. The sun god illuminates all the surrounding planetary systems. However, when the sun is on the northern side of the hill, the south receives less light. And when the sun is in the south, the north receives less. Actually, this is about winter and summer. Priyavrata disliked this situation, therefore decided to make daylight in the part of the universe where there was night. He followed the orbit of the sun guide on a brilliant chariot and thus fulfilled his desire. He could perform such wonderful activities because of the power he achieved by worshiping the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Now here's the added sentence in some manuscripts. You see, one thing is, you notice this text is not in verse. It's in prose. Approaching Priyavrata, who was acting thus, the four-faced Brahma chided him. This is not what you're supposed to do. It was like a little insulting to the sun god. So then in his purport, Prabhupada just talks about how... So immediately Prabhupada gets, from the description of this verse, it appears that the sun moves. In other words, he's not solar, it's a centric system, it's geocentric. But here it is rotating in its prescribed orbit, and so on. 6 months on the northern side, here where it says 6 months and 6 months, which means when the summer in the north, winter in the south, right? So when the sun, the way it's this, Do you know, people know this stuff, that the sun doesn't always hit the earth only certain times at a straight on angle. It tends at the equator all the time. But otherwise, of course, our explanation that we were told in grade school is that the earth is tilted with respect to the sun. But from our point of view, it looks like just now, if you look at noon, the sun is way off in the north because it's wintertime and the sun's in the north. Way up in the south. And so it's sort of in the middle period, it'll be right overhead, but other times it'll be more rising and setting. As cores running further to the south in the wintertime. And so that's what this is talking about. And if you take when the sun rays are perpendicular, the highest up the sun goes. From it is north of the equator and south of the equator, and the highest it goes, I think it's 23.5 degrees. I don't remember the degrees, but one is the northern one is called the Tropic of Cancer, and the southern one is the Tropic of Capricorn. And the sun, you know, rays go between those two lines. So this is what this is talking about. But actually, if the Earth is stationary, then definitely it looks like the sun is sometimes in the north and sometimes moving to the south. So he didn't like this. So Maharaj Prithvirata made a second sun, and there it is. So this is discussed. When Prithvirata drove his chariot behind the suns, the rims of his chariot wheels created impressions that later became seven oceans, dividing the planetary system known as Bhumandala into seven islands. So here you have an event that has cosmological significance. There's several of them if you start to think of it: the moon out of the milk ocean. And these are things that happen. So, in other words, what it is suggesting, before this time, Bhumandala was a single tract of land undivided by oceans. And now, here's one place, and there are other places, where Prabhupada uses the word islands to verse planets in the outer space. I can show you another place where he does this. This is significant because sometimes the ring islands by Prabhupada are identified as planets in outer space, as in here. This is really the basis of Sariputta's pointing out that Bhumandala, if you try to identify it with any features we can see, it's the plane of the ecliptic. You know what the plane of the ecliptic is? Well, because the sun is north and south, in other words, the sun, and by the way, the solar system, is at an angle to the earth. It's not level with the equator. It's like this. It's tilted up 23.5 degrees. And that's the plane called the plane of the ecliptic. And because the sun is just a little bit above the ring islands, I forgot how many, the height of the Manasultra mountain, basically a little more, and going around. So that's basically in the solar system as we see it now. The sun and all the planets are on the same plane, except for Pluto, which maybe doesn't count anymore. It's been demoted into a planetoid entity or something. They don't know what to do. So So that's a view of Bhumandala that associates it with the plane of the ecliptic. So here he says, I'll show you the other place too, where this is mentioned. Let's see. I'm trying to make use of all these facilities here. Yeah, here we go. This is in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, where this is Mahaprabhu talking to Sanatana Goswami, so no less an authority. He says, within the universe, the Lord is situated in different spiritual manifestations. These are situated on 7 islands in 9 sections. Thus, their pastimes are going on. Now, Mahaprabhu is referring to this part of the Bhagavatam, because the 7 islands is Saptadweep. So those are the Jambudweep and the Ring Islands, right? Those are the 7 islands. Navakanda, Navakanda means 9. The same thing as Varsha, as we shall see. Because basically, Prabhupada has a purport in which he is defining 2 words, dvipa and kanda. So the 7 islands are mentioned in the Siddhanta Shiromani. That's in itself interesting that he quotes the Siddhanta Shiromani, because that we talked yesterday, remember, about these books called the Siddhantic texts of the astronomers who have have been debating the Puranikas, those guys, our guys, for a long time. So Prabhupada quotes this, and they mention the 7 islands, and here they are from the Siddhanta Shiromani. The 7 dvipas are Jambu, Shaka, Shamali, Kusha, Kauncha, Gomeda, Plaksha, and Pushkara. Those are the ones in the Bhagavatam. The planets are called dvipas. Outer space is like, now see what he says? Outer space is like an ocean of air. Just as there are islands in the watery ocean, these planets, now he's calling them planets, in the ocean of space are called dvipas, or islands in outer space. Okay, he says this. Now this is, as far as I can tell, this is not in the text. The text just says one after another they increase in size. But it doesn't say this. This is the kind of research we are doing. Now we're going to look at the commentary that Bhaktisiddhanta Prabhupada was following. I haven't done it yet. And see where Prabhupada got this from. Because this accepts what's described as ring islands. On Bhumandala, here they're identified with planets in outer space. This is, I'm pretty sure, the view of the astrological school. Just to let you know. Then the khandas, he mentions though the varshas in on Jambudweep. They are different parts of Jambudweep. A valley between 2 mountains is called khanda or varsha. So that's the definition of varsha, by the way, is a valley between 2 mountains. So now you know. So anyway, we're back to here again. I'll go back to my, okay, here we are. So we're looking at when he made these ring islands. Now we're on a solid piece of land, and he's going around in his chariot, making these ring islands. Now, so Prabhupada's purport considers the fact that the sun moves and how this works, right? Yeah, here his chariot wheels and created these things. Now, how does this happen, right? Well, okay. Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur has this, which Prabhupada doesn't really put into his commentary. But he says there are 7 single-wheeled chariots. Well, each ocean is twice the size. They're bigger things, right?
single wheel pedal.
I like it. You know those bicycles?
Oh, unicycle.
Unicycle.
Interesting.
They have very good balance in that.
He says that there are single seven-wheel chariots made by the strength of Priyavrata's yoga. That is his mystic power, is whatever you want to call it. The chariots are described as a puchchatara as compared to the sun. Question mark, because this word we have to do a little more research on, because pucha means tail, and this means a puchchatara means having a smaller tail. So I assume a pucha with reference to a chariot is some kind of chariot part. Anyway, so it's a little different from the sun chariot. We'll find out what exactly it means. Quoting Jiva Goswami, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says, the increasing width of the ring ocean implies the increasing size of the chariots. Right? He also says that others say Priyavrata wanted his chariot to be always visible to his subjects in Aryavarta, and for this reason each successive chariot surpassed in characteristics the previous one. Aryavarta meaning Jambudvipa, or at least Bharatvarsha. So the further away you are, the bigger the chariot has to be so people can see it. That's what he's saying. Because of the increased size of the wheel rims of the chariots, the various ditch oceans are seen to be of greater size. And then there's something about, something a little obscure to me, but this is a work in progress. I'm sorry I don't have the answer here. So anyway, I think he's talking about the fact that when it's summer, the days are longer. According to Bhagavatam, the sun is moving slower. And the winter, when the days are shorter, he's speeding up. That's how it understands this. Right. Anyway, so just give you an example of the kind of information that we need to go through and translate all the commentaries. Because did you ever ask yourself why this, how the chariot made these ruts that are progressively wider and wider? I have another question. The oceans are filled with various liquids. Where do they come from? I mean, when you make a rut in the ground, they fill with water. Where do these come from? I really don't know.
Also says it tastes like that, not that it's made of exactly.
Are you know where that said that it tastes like that, but it's not?
It's in this chapter.
In this chapter here?
Yeah.
Well, I didn't see that. I heard that too.
It's in the chapter. Yeah, I saw it too, but I don't have it.
Yeah, well, and then it says surrounded by a liquid substance. As a different type of liquid, it says here. Okay. Oh, emulsified yogurt is described by Vishnu Chakravarti and Sridhar Swami as churned yogurt. It means it's smoothed out, it's not lumpy.
Yeah, it's like
chicken. I mean, I figured the milk ocean, I assume this, the milk ocean is where that's the milk ocean. There's another milk ocean, but I assume this milk ocean is the one that they churned with Mandara Mountain. Yeah. And because all kinds of things came out, it's unusual milk, to be sure. But some of the people, I don't know, there's maybe another milk ocean.
Is there right in the text?
13, 14.
Of what chapter?
16.
16, 13, 14? Okay. I'll go back and see. Let me see. I don't remember that.
Yeah.
13 and 14.
Yeah.
This is too long. I miss pages sometimes.
Yeah.
Oh, it says taste just like. Yeah, well, here's the thing. He says that. You notice it's not in the Sanskrit. It just says, Payu, Madhu, Ikshurasa, Mr. Jala. Then it talks about. But this is also not these rings. This is not these lakes. These are the lakes between the mountains that belt Sumeru. So it says they taste just like. And the Sanskrit doesn't say that. And there's no purport. So I don't know exactly where that comes from. Yeah, that's why I had my doubts about that, because I heard it. But then when I looked in the Sanskrit, so I don't know if Prabhupada's just using this as a way of talking, or whether he's saying, whether there's somebody said that somewhere. So those are the kind of things you got to check out. Oops. This mixed up. Let's see if we're finished with the chariot here. Oh, I hate this. Yeah, it really is. It crashes so many times. It's really unstable. You got to be so careful when you add annotations. You got to save right away. You save up too many and try to save it. It crashes. And just you do too many things like I was just doing. It tends to flip out. I'm sorry about that. So let's go back. Do I have a bookmark there? I don't know. I'll have to go back to 16. I'll just have a bookmark at 5:1. Okay, here we go. Okay. Where are we? Anything else here? Yeah, churned yogurt. And then he gives the islands to his sons. Now it's very interesting, and I don't know what to make of this, but all their names, I think it mentions later on here somewhere, all their names are names of Agni. Everything has to do with sacrifice. And Bharhismati, also, Bharhis is kusa grass, so it means having kusa grass, or also a fire, both. So there's just this interesting thing here with every one of them. Yeah, so so he, this is what he says, and then the genealogy, then the story goes on about Priyavrata and what he does and his sons. So then at a certain point, Maharaj Pariksha has been saving this question up. You told me about Bhumandala. This is a kind of interesting thing here in the purport, by the way, the same one. You notice how Prabhupada, he does this all the time. He uses 93 million miles from the sun to earth, which is a modern number. And then sometimes adds numbers from, he calls it our modern distinguished estimation. This is an interesting language of Prabhupada's there. Okay. So now he says, huh?
Was that clickable? Did we capture it? You had it in a different color, was it clicking?
No, no, it's difficult because it's, if there's some interesting phrase, I'll use that color. If it's just conceptual interesting, I use yellow. That's what I do. Now he's asking for more details about this. Here's the word vishesha vikalpa, that means distinct or particular manner of creation. Vishesha vikalpa, the mode of construction, a distinct manner of creation. Because of the seven oceans, Bhumandala is divided into seven islands. You've given a general description of their measurement, names and characteristics. Now I wish to know them in detail. From the point of view of measurement, you know, please let me do this, right? So he's asking now for this kind of geographical knowledge. And he says this. It's a very interesting thing he says. Now, this is where this description begins. When the mind is fixed upon the Supreme Personality of Godhead and his external feature made of the material modes of nature, the gross universal form, you can see up here, stula rupa, stula rupa in the locative. Was you in the second camp?
Second camp to the Shukshma thing, the same word, finer.
So you're reading this verse? No.
No, it's the second canto.
Second canto, right, yeah. Yeah, that's because it's universal form is discussed there. So this is, again, what this is now, he's asking about this. He says, so this is the same, the stula rupa, the shukshma, right, and the same word is here too, yeah, right. I think shukshma is in here somewhere. Shukshmatame is... smaller form is the Paramatma, in the heart, it says here. Who is Atma Jyotishi, Para Brahmani, Bhagavati, known as Vasu. So when the mind is fixed in his external feature made of the material modes of nature, the gross universal form, it is brought to the platform of pure goodness. In that transcendental position, one can understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vasudevanus, who in his subtler form is self-effulgent and beyond the modes of material nature. Oh, my Lord, please vividly describe how that form which covers the entire universe is perceived. That form which covers the entire universe means the stula rupa. Now, this is a very interesting purport. How Prabhupada says this. He's already been advised by a spiritual master to think of the universal form. That's what you've just been reading in the Bhagavatam. And therefore, following the advice of his spiritual master, he continuously thought of that form. The universal form is certainly material, but because everything is an expansion of the energy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, ultimately nothing is material. How's your love? It both is and is not. Well, you know, there was an observation made, and this is something to bear in mind when I'm trying to understand the Bhagavatam. There was an observation made by an Indian professor at the University of Chicago, a very prominent guy named A.K. Ramanujan. And he made a distinction between Western thinking and Indian thinking, Vedic thinking, we could say. And he said, Western thinking tends to be context invariant, but Indian thinking is context specific. You know, the way the Western people think is just we want a general rule, and you want to apply everywhere, and that's it. But in the Indian context, is it material? Like, come on, either it's material or spiritual, one or the other, choose, you know. No, in one context it's material, and in another context it's spiritual. Ultimately spiritual, but there's two ways of looking at this. Yeah, all over the place. You start looking around. That's why Prabhupada, you know, I could go through Prabhupada. And if you give me any question, I can find, not any question, but most questions, I can find Prabhupada arguing on both sides. Householder life is good, householder life is bad. You know, you can because he's talking about the context. And, you know, devotees, they have an issue, and they go to the folio, and they get their quotes to back it up, the Prabhupada says, and they throw these snowball fights at each other, you know, and it's like... So, in other words, it's material, because it's... In fact, I asked Prabhupada this question, as a matter of fact, about everything being spiritual, because we were walking in the morning in New Vrindavan. I was, you know, just a few years into the movement. And somehow or other, we're going through the woods, and Prabhupada mentions starts mentioning how ultimately everything is spiritual. And he pointed to these trees, and he said, this wood, he says, is fire, but in another form. The tree absorbs the sunlight, and it grows the wood. And it looks like wood, but actually, if you ignite it again, the fire comes. So it's really fire in another form. Similarly, he said, everything is actually spirit. He was going on in this vein for some time, and I was getting a little upset and confused. So finally I got a question in. I said, this is just exactly what's going on. Srila Prabhupada, I'm trying really hard to understand the difference between matter and spirit, because I know the first thing we have to understand is I'm not my body, my body's material, and I'm spirit. So I'm trying to understand the distinction, and now you're saying everything is spirit. So what am I, I'm a little confused. And this is what he said to me, he says, we are not Maya bodies. He says, there are different kinds of spirit.
That was clear.
But the purport in Bhagavatam, like to 424, Brahmarpanam, Brahmahavir, Brahma, you know, sacrifice, everything becomes Brahma. Prabhupada has a wonderful purport about how basically by devotional service and sacrifice you turn matter into, back to spirit, its original spiritual form. So in other words, when everything is seen and used in connection with Krishna, then it's spirit. If Krishna is disassociated by our mental efforts, then it attains this characteristic called matter. So so the universal form is certainly material, because everything is an expansion of the energy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Ultimately, nothing is material. Therefore, Krishna's mind was saturated with spiritual consciousness. Even though he was thinking of the stula rupa, the gross form, still, because he was thinking of Krishna in connection with the universe, and the universe in relationship to Krishna. Then there's some things about engaging everything in Krishna's service. That's how spiritualize you. You engage things in our service, the spiritual part vanishes. You use it for Krishna. Even the senses, when purified, are spiritual. So Maharaj Pariksit, was situated on the transcendental platform. Therefore, although he might not have any reason to be concerned with the detailed information of the universe, he's not a tourist, he's not highly curious, he was thinking of it in relationship with the Supreme Lord, and therefore, such geographical knowledge was not material but transcendental. So it's transcendental geography. That's exactly what it says here. And to me, this is sort of maybe a hermeneutical key to this. This is the universe from the spiritual vision, angle of vision. Elsewhere in the Bhagavatam, Nikosarda Muni, the entire universe is also the Supreme Personality of God, although it appears different from Him. And then Prabhupada has a practical application about using these things. I think Vishnu Chakravarti says in the purport that he, Maharaj Pariksit, says this because he's thinking maybe you'll think he's he's feeling maybe a little bit embarrassed that you think he's concerned about something material, so he just wants to say like this. Then if you go, I'm sorry, I don't have this link to this, but if you go to the very end of the fifth canto, when you get all the way down, you go up, you know, through the whole creation, description of the hellish planets, and we come all the way down to the end of that. This is the way to get there. This is the worst chapter in the Bhagavatam. Maharaj Pariksit didn't like it either. Yeah. Now see, you're right at the end again. He mentions the hellish planets. And then he says, this is how it is. It's the, again mentioning the Virat Rupa. So in other words, in the beginning, I have already described how one can progress in the path of liberation. And the prana is the vast universal existence, which is like an egg divided into 14 parts, as described. This vast form is considered the external body of the Lord, created by His energies and qualities, is generally called the Virat Rupa. If one reads the description of this external form of the Lord with great faith, or if one hears about it or explains it to others to propagate Bhagavad Dharma, Krishna consciousness, his faith and devotion and spiritual consciousness, Krishna consciousness will gradually increase. Although developing this consciousness is very difficult, by this process one can purify himself and gradually come to awareness of the Supreme Absolute Truth. This is the conclusion. So in the beginning of the description of the transcendental geography and the end, they describe it both as being another way of seeing the universal form of the Lord. And there are features of this, the features of this in particular that are very interesting. For example, do you know the name of the spinal column in Sanskrit? What it's called? Meru Danda. Mm-hmm. And what's the top? Brahma Rudra. I mean, it's... And also, there's a great deal of attention to Vastu. And here in the Vastu Purusha and the directions and everything, you see the way that the devatas have their headquarters, or their, probably call them their summer houses, on the top of Mount Meru, like a hill station. that's the same demigods that Lokapalas are in charge of the directions that are being used in Vastu. And so these are just some other aspects of this that need exploring. The Meru Danda thing is very interesting to me, and I would like to find out whether there's any other medical analogies here in this description. But in any case, however particular it is, this is also the Virat Rupa. And the Virat Rupa has been described a number of places as imaginary, or something close to imagination. That may be taken simply to mean this is not the spiritual body, the real spiritual body of Krishna. Or it's, when you say the mountains are his bones, he doesn't literally have bones, and so on. It's kind of a figurative language, but it's more than just artistic. It's not because it purifies the mind, it brings you closer to Krishna, allows you to come to where you can perceive the subtle form, because that's already explained in the Bhagavatam, how by concentrating on this, which is a kind of the external feature of the super soul, you come to see the super soul. So I don't know how exactly this will pan out, but I think this is, seems to me, the fact that this whole thing is bracketed very explicitly and described as the universal Virarupa or the Shtura Rupa of the Lord, is something about understanding how it doesn't exactly look like. We see a river, but like when you look at the universal form, we see the rivers and we think these are his veins. We see the trees and the vegetation, these are the hairs on his body. We see the mountains, these are his bones. But we don't really see, it's identified in a different way. So I just wonder about this one. And with that, I just think it's significant that this is what we're doing. In other words, at any rate, this is how, if you want to see the universe in relationship to Krishna, this is how it's seen. And ultimately, that must be the way to see it, in relationship to Krishna. Another issue is the fact that any of these descriptions, here you're giving a certain way to look at the universe. Or even philosophically, you're giving categories to see the world. In the Bhagavad Gita already, the three modes of nature. We look at the world in terms of the three modes of nature. And we can see it working. We find out how it's useful applied knowledge for us, because we want to see the mode of goodness develop, and we want to see passion and ignorance decrease. Also, it explains the varnas. If you start to look for it, the three modes of nature, you see it everywhere. Before somebody told us sattva guna, rajaguna, tamaguna, we know things are being created, things are being maintained, and things are being destroyed. But now that's our, everybody has that experience, and now we find out that kind of those categories have other dimensions. And you start to look at the world through those categories, it lights up the world in a certain way. And it's very useful for our purposes. Krishna says to Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita, in the 7th chapter, now I'm going to describe to you all that there is as material and spiritual, and beyond this there is nothing more to be known. And he does it. Apir, Anilova, these are my separated material energies. Now when you look at those, and he said this is this one energy, and here's this other energy, the spirit souls, they come together, and out of their confluence this universe is there. Both of them come from me, and beyond me there's nothing more, that's it. That's why the prophet says knowledge needs to know matter and spirit, and what's the origin of both. There it is. You know everything about it. It's really quite an achievement to do that. So, but then you look at this list, earth, water, fire, air, ether, it looks so archaic and old-fashioned. And You know, because when I sat in classrooms and they have the periodic table of the elements, I don't know how they keep adding them, but I don't know how they're, what they've gotten up to now. How do you know, you understand how it works and how it goes on, and then you look at earth, water, fire, and ether, you think, wow, you know, this is a periodic table, that's really sophisticated, and we can do all kinds of things with it. What can we do with earth, water, fire, air, and ether? And is the periodic table wrong? But see, this is a similar sort of issue that you have with the fifth canto. I would say that really, you know, if you start looking at the ultimate things, protons, electrons, and neutrons, you know that nobody has ever seen these. Maybe you've seen pictures of an atom, or a molecule anyway, with all the atoms arranged like this. Well, they're dots on a phosphorescent screen. It's really not a photograph. It's really, there's some laboratory apparatus that something happens somewhere and it makes that pattern of dots on the screen. These entities are in principle unperceivable by us. They're just, we can't see them. And we do certain things that it makes this pattern, and we say, yeah, that's what they look like, but that's... And so really strict empirical philosophers, who sometimes do philosophy of science, they call protons, electrons, and neutrons metaphysical entities. And they say, they say that really, you see, well, in science, you don't really find out truths about the world. Rather, you have a theory. And the theory, by the way, we talk about protons, electrons, and neutrons, and maybe we have this image of a little solar system or something, you know. But actually, you know, that's all fanciful. Really, the theory is a proton is a certain cluster of mathematical terms, electrons, it's all mathematics. It's just, they're mathematical formulas. And the theory is just this mathematical formula. Now, if you have a picture of what it looks like, then you have an interpretation of the theory, but it's not really the theory. Sometimes the same theory has widely different interpretations. In quantum mechanics, they have this problem. Because otherwise, because nobody understands it. The theory, if you try to imagine anything like it, doesn't make sense. But it works. Works what? You plug in one set of observed data into the formulas, you do the math, and you pop out another set of observed data, which turns out you can predict accurately what's going to happen. And we call that, therefore it's true. So really, you know, this group of philosophers say that a scientific theory doesn't really tell us about the world, it's just an inference ticket to allow us to get from one set of observed data that we can see to another set of observed data. Now, a lot of scientists are upset about this because they really think that tells us about the guts of the world. But I think, strictly speaking, this is probably quite true. So they have these protons, electrons, neutrons, and so on, and it works. Do I really think it tells us ultimately what's in the world? No. Because whatever was there before has been replaced by this, and I'll guarantee you, it'll be replaced by something else. You know, maybe that will include what's this, but you know, it'll be replaced. It's just like Newton's theories. They work, but they're really wrong about how the world is. At least what everybody thinks now, because of relativity theory. And from when Newton propounded his theories, there are objections right from the beginning that there were things that didn't account for. Had these mysterious occult forces called gravity, which People still don't know what that is. Now, one thing in the distance, gravel or something, no. I'm not so worried about earth, water, fire, air, ether. Because these are the categories Krishna has given us. For what? For our purpose. Our purpose is to see our way out of the material world and into the spiritual world. That's what we want to do. And so this way of showing the world will help us do this. In other words, it's a map for the trip we want to take. Now, in the 11th canto, it's asked, Uddhava asked Krishna, I think. Some philosophers say there's 16, and some people say there's this many, so how many are there? And Krishna says, well, since every element contains all the other, you can divide them up any way you want. They're all right. But he's given us this particular set, and we use it. We take our trip. It's a map. But the map is not the territory. The map takes up certain features of the territory for certain purposes. If we want to use the Bhagavatam map to explore for oil, then it probably won't help us. This, you know, to do chemistry, it's not designed to help us do this kind of chemistry. Is it wrong? No, it's not wrong. It's the map. And one reason we have two reasons to trust it. One is that it suits the thing we want. This is the map that tells you how to get out of the material world. For those people who are not interested in getting out of the material world, it will appear useless. And the other thing is given by Krishna, so it has a certain security about it. It's not somebody else's made up map, it's the one that Krishna's given us. I'm sure it doesn't exhaust everything there is to know about this world or about the spiritual world, there's much, much more, but it's the one he's given us. And it's good for our purposes. So this is kind of the framework in which I think of the fifth canto. It's a map of the universe that shows us how everything looks in relationship to Krishna. Those people who have seen this, and they can see it, it is not an imagination in the sense that it doesn't exist. The people have seen it and described it. This is how the world looks to rishis and devatas and so on. Yeah.
He said how everything is in relation to Krishna. So, for relationship, it needs to be both signs and it needs to be conscious.
I'm sorry?
You said that we need to look at the universe and how everything is related to Krishna.
Yeah, correct, yeah.
So, this is how I understood, just correct me if I'm wrong, that is that meaning that actually everything stays, I don't know if I can express this, but upon the living entities who are living on those planets, because they can only have relationship to Krishna. I don't see how is that related. I just understand everything we have to look at the universe. Mm-hmm. How it is related to Krishna.
Well, I when you look at the fifth canto, you see a universe in which at every point it is arranged by Krishna. It's arranged for the living entities. The whole creation is for the sake of the living entities.
Yeah.
And this is part of that. If you read what we're looking at now, this creation is called Visarga, the creation that's made by Brahma. If you look at the Sarga, you find everything evolves out of what? False ego. So who is false ego for? It's for living entities. You find out that the whole universe from the very beginning is made for the living entities, so they can actually come back to Krishna. So everything evolves up. There's false ego, and then one of the primordial things are the sense objects and the senses. Now right now there's no bodies yet, but there are these what you can call powers or potentialities for the senses and the sense objects. Sense objects mean the color, not this color or that color, but whatever is the object of the sense of sight. That's a tan mantra. The sense objects are not the things we see, but the components that make them up, or taste, or touch, or smell. All that's assembled right from the very beginning, when you have the different 23 elements. It's all from the outset for the sake of the living entities. This is in strong contrast to the prevailing mythology that somehow there's nothing, and this nothing produces something. I mean, Aristotle said, ex nihil nihil fit, nothing comes from nothing, but we reject that now, because now the whole thing is to make it sound plausible that everything comes from nothing. You know, there's this, somehow or other, there's this nothing, but maybe a pretty potent nothing, somehow or other. And then there's this evolution that takes place, molecular evolution, atomic evolution, molecular evolution. You get carbon chains, and then you get biological evolution. And so, and then at a very late accidental thing, look, there's human beings. There's nothing's created for the sake of anything, it's just there. There's a sort of an accident that's here. I have this far out screensaver. Joe's torn, it doesn't want to change when it's hooked up. Anyway, there's great shots of tornadoes. And so I grew up in Texas and Oklahoma, it makes me feel right at home. I lost my train of thought. By the way, tornadoes are used to try to explain the self-organization of matter too. And hurricanes and stuff. And we really want to do this, everything comes from nothing. Yes, so everything is for the sake of the living entities, and that's how this creation. And so this way also, and that's the sarga, and this is the visarga. Again, everything is there for the sake of the living entities. And you see in this description all the different planetary systems, and everything is arranged in terms of people's karma and their relationship to God, and people at the bottom being punished, and then you have that wonderful place, the Bila Svarga, the heavens in a hole, where the anti-gods live and do their thing, these little boxes down there somewhere. Then you have Bhumandala, you have all these different places, with especially Varsha being a very special region, according to Bhagavatam, and then have the heavenly planets, and then all the way up to Brahmaloka. I mean, that's just as Krishna arranged it, and all the connection with Krishna. It's just a really different vision. It's all pervaded by Krishna. And you see people everywhere are worshipping Krishna in various forms. Creation takes place by sacrifice. Everybody's performing sacrifice. So this is, I think that's what it means in relationship to Krishna.
When I was reading this, a thought came to my mind, just trying to put everything into perspective, just kind of like when you read the universal form of Bhagavad Gita, you're trying to put it into perspective. What does it mean when you say you saw everything in one place, all the planetary systems, and you know, everything, all this, you saw in one place. So I was kind of thinking, like, if you were an ant on this floor, and you were trying to navigate your way, you know what I mean, from one part of the Mayapur campus to the temple. I mean, this, the description of this in ant ratios would be similar, you know what I mean? It would be beyond the capacity of an ant to comprehend the distance between, you know, MP15 to, or HP15 to the temple. So is there, I mean, we're looking for this, like we're saying, well, how does this work with what we see? But what do we see? And how much, you know, how much can we consider what we see to be even relevant to what this is?
Remember what Prabhupada said this morning, one devotee playing the point of part of the sign, he said, Prabhupada, we have that scene, and Prabhupada said, what have you seen inside of your mother's womb?
That's kind of where it's at.
If we
consider our size in relation to the universe, or the universe is, you know, then like what Brahma, he considered himself to be a big deal until he met all the other Lord Brahmas who had 10,000 heads, etc., etc., etc. So where do we put ourselves, and how can we even conceive of seeing this in proportion from where we stand? It's
yeah, exactly. It's Sadhguru talks a lot about higher dimensions. And Bhaktisiddhanta mentioned somewhere that I read, he said, we learn about more than three dimensions from mathematics, because in mathematics you can have any number of dimensions, although we can only function in three. But there's a whole mathematical science that deals with four-dimensional. You know, if you take a strip of paper and you give it a half twist and glue it together, you have basically you have one surface. You put a pencil on it, you have to lift it up, and you go on the inside and the outside. But that's a two-dimensional object. But it's a two-dimensional object that only exists in three-dimensional space. So people also have designed three-dimensional objects that only can exist in four-dimensional space. If we can't make one, a real one, that's sort of like a Klein bottle, but, you know. And you can just keep on going like that. So all of these things are mathematically and logically possible. Science requires them, right? Modern science has to use more than three dimensions. And I think it's clear that we're also trying to look at something that has certainly more than three dimensions. The other thing is to remember, I think almost all devotees accept that the yoga siddhis are true. Where I can reach here, and I'll hand you a flower from a rose garden in San Diego. Now, what happened? Did my hand? Oh, by the way, the prophet said these cities are not miraculous, in the sense that they are fully within the laws of material nature. In the sense that somebody breaks the laws of nature, they're
there's
not.
One city, huh? There's one city that goes against the laws of material nature.
Yeah, that's how it's said, but it doesn't. But anyway, his general description is they are according to the general laws of nature. And you know, if you can break the laws, there's probably a law.
The way he says it is that all the first seven, in the list, they are within the laws of material nature. They're anything that can be conceived, and then the last one is something that you can't conceive.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Beyond your ability.
But anyway, the cities are something that, at least for the most part, happen within the laws of nature. In another place, Prabhupada said, miracle simply means you don't know how it's done. And in fact, Arthur C. Clarke, the famous science fiction writer, said, any sufficiently advanced technology looks like a miracle. I remember even here in Mayapur, I guess our second trip, we had to shave a water pump with cold water. At that time in America, somebody had come up with self-heating shaving foam. You know, they have a can, they have two separate chemicals, and they, when you squirt them out, it makes foam, and the two chemicals together, and it's an exothermic reaction, so that it just heats up drastic. It's really hot right in your hand, it is. So the guy thought, wow, man, we're going to have to shave, and with cold water, this will be really nice to have. So there's about four of us standing outside the pump in the morning, trying to shave. And the guy showed us all this self-heating shaving cream. We're talking about it. It was some local guy, Dobie Wallace, something comes by and kind of gets interested and comes over. And the devotee has him hold out his hand. He squirts the shaving cream in his hand. It got really hot. The devotee said, "Bhagavan, Bhagavan." It's not a miracle, you know, it's an exothermic reaction. So if we know that the yoga cities work, that means the universe is really, really different than most people imagine. But when I go get the rose in San Diego, it doesn't mean my arm goes stretching, you know, across the Pacific Ocean. And, you know, it means that somehow or other this space and that space can be folded up onto each other so they touch, and I can do it.
Like Vrindavan.
Yeah, like Vrindavan is described like that. And then a yogi is somebody who knows how to manipulate the folds of space. And so the Bhagavatam is definitely happening in that universe. And so right away, you realize that we are, it's even more drastic than the ant. Well, the ant, this is, ant may be almost two dimensions, but we are dealing with things that are just beyond our experience. So, but people who know how to do things have described it to us as best as we can understand. And in the course of time, we also may see these.
Could watch Twister.
Yeah, it's a great website. these tornado chasers, you know. So that's what happens in this case. Maybe we should get back to him.
When you describe the higher and the middle and the lower planetary system, so Bhumandala encompasses all three planetary systems.
No. Bhumandala is middle earth.
The earthly plane.
Huh?
The earthly plane. We're talking about the middle of the planetary system. The Bhumandala.
Yeah, that's Bhumandala. That's the Bhu.
So then how does it describe Brahmapuri and all these in Bhumandala itself?
That's describing, Brahma has his place up in Satchaloka.
So
but also on top of Meru, he's got a city too. How many rich people you know have more than one place?
So it's like a city's office.
Yeah.
No, but it's hill station.
Brahma has a place, and the different Lokapalas have places there. And as we discover that eight of the Varshas are, but especially Ilavatavarsha is a vacation party ground for the devatas. They like to go there to have a good time. Yeah, this is where they go. You'll find very many people are going. I have a whole list of who goes to Ilavatavarsha, including Kardama Muni and Devahuti on their honeymoon tour. That's definitely where they went to have a good time. These mountains are in gardens and lakes around Sumeru with the different tasting waters or different waters and so on. So they come down there. So they have many residences. So Meru's there. So this Swarga, this Bhuvar Swar. Bhuvar is the space in between, Antariksha. Then there's Swar, which is where the devatas are. Then there's then and we have a description of three heavens. Swarga, Bhumi Swarga, heaven on earth, and the other eight varshas, and this are our heavens on earth, and then Vila Swarga. The terrestrial paradise. Remember how many people in the Renaissance and you know went to America looking for this terrestrial paradise?
In Florida.
Yeah, Florida. Yeah, and they found it too.
So it means after all, Jehovah's Witnesses are right.
In what respect?
Well, heaven on earth.
They have a different version of that. Those people don't understand, they're not their bodies even, so it's a little weird. They wouldn't like it. Okay, let's see if we have any more to say about this. Oh yeah, he says, the material world is only one-fourth of God's creation, Supreme Personality of Godhead, but it is unlimited and impossible for anyone to know or describe, even with the qualification of a life as long as that of Brahma, who lives for millions and millions of years. Modern scientists and astronomers, this is the purport. Yeah, so here he says, here's the verse. My dear King, there's no limit to the expansion of the Supreme Personality of Godhead material energy. The material world is a transformation of the material qualities, yet no one could possibly explain it perfectly, even in a lifetime as long as that of Brahma. No one in the material world is perfect, and an imperfect person could not describe this material universe accurately, even after continued speculation. O King, I shall nevertheless try to explain to you the principal regions, such as Bhuloka, which is Bhumandala, with their names, forms, measurements, and various symptoms. The word Bhugoloka, Goloka, it means a globe, by the way. Yeah. So that's what, you know, the statement of the difficulty of the task. And of course, here Prabhupada makes his point here. He wanted to give the king as much knowledge as he had received through the Parampara system. Well, Prabhupada sometimes says the spiritual master knows everything. Prabhupada was asked, what does that mean? He says, everything his spiritual master taught him.
He wants to say whatever Krishna wants.
Or whatever Krishna wants, you know. It's not that he's like God.
I actually heard discussing that with some disciples, and he said, you have not understood. Mm-hmm. It is not like that, you know. Mm-hmm. We tend to take these things very literally.
Yeah.
And Prabhupada, he didn't really, you know, when he heard us do that, he was like, what do you think?
Yeah, there's still people around who want to, but that's true. So Prabhupada says here, the limits of the expansion of Govinda cannot be estimated by anyone, even a person as perfect as Brahma, not to speak of tiny scientists whose senses and instruments are all imperfect and who cannot give us information of even this one universe. We should therefore be satisfied with the information obtainable from Vedic sources as spoken by authorities like Shukadeva Goswami. This is Prabhupada's viewpoint. You know, there's just no doubt about it. And he reiterates it. And so now the planetary system known as Bhumandala resembles a lotus flower, and its seven islands resemble the whorl of that flower. And then the length and the breadth of the island known as Jambudvip is 1 million yojanas. Now this figure, it says 1 million yojanas, but later on, we see the word niyuta, which is the translation, a very high number, generally a million. However, in a couple of verses later on, the text says of Meru that it is, its height is the same as the measurement of the width of Jambudvip, and the purport that measure stated as 100,000 yojanas. So in commenting on this, it's Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati who says a million. But Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur gives 100,000. Jiva says, the word Niyuta, although usually denoting 1 million, here somehow denotes 10,000, 100,000, and that is understood because of the context. Vira Raghava and Sridhar Swami also agree, 100,000. Vamsidhar repeats Jiva, all others 100,000. And then another. So all the acharyas, but Bhakti Siddhanta says what he does say, a million. Why, I don't know. Because that's a common meaning of the word. And it sometimes happens that somebody comes and just translates something and don't bother to go back and, oh yeah, right, it has to be the other meaning. So something like that, I don't know. This word Kuvala is the blue lily, usually, but here is described as a lotus. And so then they in Jambudvip, there are 9 divisions of land. This is that we just saw this one, what a varsha is. Khanda also means division, you know. And so now we have this general description from the Vayu Purana. So the varshas are generally 9,000 yojana. Notice yojana we're thinking of as 8 mile, an 8 mile. But the middle three varshas, middle three means right in the middle is Ilavritta Varsha, then to the right is Badrashva Varsha, and the left is Ketumala Varsha, right? Mm-hmm. They're wider than the others. So there are 34,000 yojanas.
It's interesting that Prabhupada puts that huge verse in there and he doesn't translate it.
Yeah, there's a few places he doesn't do that.
Yeah,
he just sticks it there. But everybody's gone through and translated them anyway. Even they did it when Prabhupada was here. You'll see later on for Vishnu Chakravarti, Prabhupada puts a whole block of stuff from Vishnu Chakravarti not translating. This is where Vishnu Chakravarti measures out that there's a space between Bhumandala and the shells of the universe. They don't conjoin. And that's why he says Shesha Naga support has to support Bhumandala. It's not tacked on to the shell of the universe. And that the elephants, these four judges on Manasotra Mountain, you can balance there, just balance the thing. And that's why also it could crash into the Garbhodak Ocean and be rescued by the Varaha because it's not fastened. So there's a space, you know how wide it is, I forget the number now. That's what it is. Shesha holds it up and these directional elephants that are up there, their job is to make sure it doesn't tilt. They're like living gyroscopes. This is also from the website, by the way, the Storm Chasers website. I love this. I made it my wallpaper. I couldn't understand why I was so attracted to it. Then I realized what it is. It's called Chanting on the Clearing Stage. That That's where you're going. You just get around. Yeah, anyway, maybe...
You've got a ways to go there.
Well, things can change fast when they have turbulent weather, that's what I'm hoping. Yeah, so I just have a little outline here, which I didn't print up, but maybe I'll do that for tomorrow, of these next couple of chapters. So you can get a chapter overview. It'd be a little hard to go through verse by verse, and we'll just stop in the strategic places. I have all my files. When we do this, hook it up, all my things get moved around. Oh, by the way, that's what a lotus looks like. You see, this is the pericarp. This is Mount Meru. Let me get a side view. I have a side view lotus too, I think. You see that? You see how it goes? Just like Meru is now at the top. Mm-hmm. There it is, wide at the top. You see those little... this is a good one. This is a really good one. You see that? You see these are called the filaments. Around Meru, there are 20 filament mountains. Now, Sataputa, people leave them out in their drawings, but they're almost as high as Meru. It says, just like these, some of them, like they're coming over the edge there. But it's a good idea to keep in mind. When we see Brahma sitting on the lotus, sometimes he's sitting up here, you know, on this seat. This is this pericarp is where, there's another one. Here's the one I was looking for, which has the, this is the classic Indian lotus here, this one. And I skipped one somehow. Right? Here's a seed pod with the seeds in it. Over here, and here's a lotus like this one. Yeah, those filament mountains are important, as we'll see. I don't know why they leave them out, but it's really almost as high as Meru. It's just here. Like that. Oh yeah, I was looking for my little thing here. Let's see. Okay. Yeah. So here's this chapter, a kind of an outline. I'll give it to you. You know, kind of a little summary of the verses. So what we'll get in this chapter is we'll get a sort of overview of Jambudvip. And then an overview of the central Varsha, which is called Ilavita Varsha. And then Ilavita in detail. And then the chapter ends with the top of Mount Sumeru being described. That's what happens in this first chapter. And then the next is the descent to the river Ganges. How the Ganges comes down and flows into the different branches, and then we go into the worship of Narayan and the nine varshas and so on. I'll hand these out to you tomorrow. Okay. Any other questions about this stuff today?
I didn't even remember when you mentioned at the beginning about the Ring Islands and the oceans, and then there's Manasatara Mountain, and then behind Manasatara Mountain there is...
It's called Kanchana Bhumi, the Golden Land. Well, Mahasodra Mantra is in the middle of one of the dvipas. What's his name? One of the dvipas. There's one of the islands. His name is escaping right now. Anyway, it goes around the middle of one of the mountains, one of the islands, Mahasodra Mountain. It's like a ring. And the sun god runs along, it's like the track.
So it's not at the end of the last seventh island?
Yeah, I think so.
Yes.
Yeah, it's the last island. I just can't remember its name. Then there's the freshwater ocean beyond that island.
Pushkar is last.
Is this Pushkar Dweep?
Yes, it's the seventh on the list.
Yeah, okay. There's Pushkar. And then there's the ocean of salt water, which is again twice as wide as that dvipa. And then there's this Kanchana Bhumi, the golden land. If I get up, have people read this book?
Yeah, there's a chart for drawing of moon.
Yeah. The only way to make this bigger is like this. Okay, you can start looking at these views of Bhumandala, different scales. You see, it really gets quite big because of the each one being 10 times wider than the one before. This is an idea of you people. Has anybody ever looked at this book, or at least the pictures? Here's what we're talking about, okay. This region, right? Where you have here's the seven, this is the scale. This is the seven islands. Oh yeah, then there's this thing that, I'm not sure about this, but he says that there's another region that's called Loka. I always thought this Loka referred to the seven islands was a collective name. Here he says it's a separate place called Loka. Then Kanchani Bhumi, which is just a sheet of gold apparently, nobody lives there. Then there's the Loka Mountains, and then this Aloka Varsha. They're not here, the edge of the universe, right? I meant to check that out, this Loka, you've got Loka in here.
What does it say? It's inhabited.
So it says a region called Loka, inhabited?
Inhabited.
No, it says inhabited.
Inhabited with the golden land. Inhabited, yeah. Inhabited means, and then uninhabited means no one lives there. Inhabited means.
So Loka is a mountain?
Yeah, Loka Mountain. That divides Loka from Aloka is called Loka Mountain.
No, but before Kanchana Bhumi, after Saptas Deep.
Huh?
After Seven Deep, after Bhumantra, there's Loka in a brown color.
I'm not sure what this is. When I thought it referred to Loka, I thought that was just a collective name for everything up to this point. But Sataputta probably knows better than I do, and that as he said, there's another region that's called Loka. Because Loka just means there's people living there. He says, here's what he says. The inhabited region, Loka, is an exception to the rule of that applies to Saptadweep. Its width is defined in the Bhagavatam verse as to be equal to the radius of the Manasutra mountain. So that's right, I'm sorry, that's right, because it's not the same. And this gives it a thickness of Svadudaka. The next ring, the golden land, Kanchan Bhumi, is a sign of goodness that brings its outer radius exactly the half the radius of Bhumandala. Yeah, there's a chart. No, no, here's not a chart. So this is the one above. And so he, there's a table which if I can blow it up, he gives us a radius here. Okay? I forgot about this loka thing. It's the same chart, right? Okay, go back. So we have these two circular mounds, this Manasultra, over which the sun travels, and this Lokaloka. Some far out things about you. Bhagavatam, Prabhupada,